Top of the morning to you, Oregon. I'm Finn J.D. John, FJ at OffbeatOregon.com, your host for today's Daily Dollop of the Offbeat Oregon History Podcast. Thanks for downloading, and I hope you enjoy it. This story was first published on September 1st, 2020, under the headline Boss Shanghaier Larry Sullivan's Mining Stock Fraud Career. This is part two of a two-part story on Larry Sullivan's second act, the Great Goldfield Mining Stock Swindle. Yesterday in part one, we talked about Larry's path to the town of Goldfield and how he met a fascinating confidence man named George Graham Rice there. At the end of part one, they had just agreed to do some deals together. Rice had won $2,500 at the gambling tables in Sullivan's saloon and told Larry that if he'd match that money with $2,500 of his own, the two of them could use it to make themselves both very rich men. Let's see how that went down.
"Okay," said Rice, "put that money in a sack and go get that big coonskin coat of yours and take a night ride by automobile to Tonopah. When you get there, look up the owner of the Jumping Jack Mine. He is a member of the Ancient Order of Hibernians. An Irishman can buy that property from him cheaper than anybody else. You go buy it."
"What will I pay?"
"He wants $85,000, but get it as cheap as you can."
"What? Were this $5,000?
"Yes. Pay him $5,000 down and sign a contract. Pay the balance in 60 or 90 days.
This was done. The two of them got the mine for $45,000 and transferred it into a corporation with 1 million shares, and then Rice got busy sending advertising orders out, along with breathless notifications to various brokerage houses back east. Larry probably had a few very bad moments over the subsequent week or two. The telegraph bill came to $1,200.
"When Sullivan learned of its size, he nearly collapsed," Rice wrote.
Then, having dipped his toe in that far, Sullivan found Rice putting the bite on him for an additional 10 grand to cover the ads he'd placed. He must have been wondering at that point whether he wasn't being taken for a ride. He found out 6 days later, when the ads appeared in newspapers all over the country.
"Within 10 days, Sullivan showed me telegraphic orders for 1,280,000 shares of Jumping Jack stock at 25 cents a share,"
Rice writes.
"That week and the next, Sullivan gave me carte blanche to speculate in local mining stocks with partnership money, and within a fortnight we had made another small fortune from Jumping Jack securities. These were advancing in price on the San Francisco Stock Exchange by leaps and bounds."
Again, this was the beginning, as Humphrey Bogart might have said, of a beautiful friendship. Soon their partnership was formalized into the Sullivan Trust Company, and the two of them had launched themselves upon a stunningly lucrative run. They'd buy up mines, incorporate them, boom them back east, and just let the money roll on in. If the mines were productive, that was great, but it was understood by all parties that mines were speculative by nature, so they could and did get away with a number of promotions of properties that never even came close to breaking even. VIP customers would often come to town to inspect their properties. Most likely the mines were salted before their arrival to encourage them, although there's no record of them having done so. It was a pretty common practice among shady mine promoters. The Sullivan Trust Company boomed up a series of mines, several of which turned out to be pretty productive. Soon they were riding a real tiger. A genuine full-fledged investment bubble was growing in mining stock investments, and Goldfield was ground zero in it. At the peak of the excitement, Larry Sullivan, who as you may know was a former professional prize fighter, was in the thick of plans to stage a battle of the century in Goldfield between Oscar Battling Nelson, the lightweight champion of the world, and former lightweight champ Joe Gans. Legendary boxing promoter Tex Rickard had come to town to back Nelson, and the Sullivan Trust Company was the primary backer for Gans. Sullivan, who'd been one of the dirtiest fighters on the Portland waterfront, became Gans's manager, and according to Rice's memoir, he did quite a bit of advance work in preparation for the fight. Having learned through the grapevine that the referee Rickard had picked really needed the work, he lodged an objection, claiming the ref was prejudiced against Gans because Gans was black. The ref, who had traveled to Goldfield from Chicago just to cover this fight, met with Sullivan to plead his cause, promising he would never dream of favoring Nelson.
"Gans is a clean fighter," Sullivan told him, "but Nelson isn't."
"If he does any fouling in this fight, I'll make him quit or declare him out," pledged the referee.
Having planted this little seed, Sullivan pronounced himself satisfied and withdrew his objection. When the fight got started, it was soon obvious that it would run long. 20 rounds in, the fighters were still battling it out, but Rice was getting worried.
"Well, this doesn't look like the cinch for Gans you said it would be," Rice whispered to Sullivan.
"Wait a minute,"
Sullivan whispered back and went to Gans's corner and held a long whispered conference with him. Upon his return, he told Rice that Gans had hurt his right wrist and didn't think he could use it for a knockout blow. But not to worry, they had a plan. During the subsequent dozen rounds or so, Gans took special pains to make it look like Nelson was fighting dirty, and he, Gans, was battling squeaky clean. By the 40th round, it was clear that Gans had gained the sympathy of the crowd. Sullivan now hurried over to Gans's corner and held another whispered conference. Apparently, it was time to spring the trap. They sprang it, according to Rice, in round 42. This was already the longest-running boxing match anyone had ever heard of, except for Sullivan, who had one that ran into the 70s under bare-knuckle rules back in the old days in Portland. But 42 was a lot. Then Gans, after taking a blow low on the midriff, dropped to the mat, clutching his crotch and howling in agony. Sullivan leaped into the ring.
"You saw that foul, didn't you?" he shouted to the referee. "It's a foul, isn't it? Gans wins, doesn't he?"
The ref, who had not seen the foul blow land if it did, was white as a ghost. He nodded and muttered something, and Sullivan raised both arms to the skies and hollered,
"Gentlemen, the referee declares Gans the winner on a foul!"
The crowd, which by now was more than ready to believe that Nelson was a foul fighter, roared its approval. Nelson's protests were drowned out. Was there a foul? The history books say there was. Rice, in his memoir, says there was not. But Rice isn't exactly a disinterested observer, so we'll never really know.
"I won that fight,"
Sullivan boasted to Rice afterwards, or so Rice writes.
"I told Gans that if he lost, he would be laying down on his friends, and that he had the audience with him, and it was time to take advantage of Nelson's foul tactics."
The Sullivan Trust Company, of course, couldn't last forever. The mines it promoted were sometimes profitable, but Rice and Sullivan didn't much care if they were or not, and as the mines started petering out overall, their batting average started to sink fast. The whole thing collapsed in 1907. The unabashed and unrepentant Rice moved on, becoming publisher of the Nevada Mining News and launching efforts to boom the town of Rawhide. Later, he got involved in another mining stock swindle, this one dedicated to manipulating the stock of the Ely Central Copper Company. This time, the collapse took him down with it temporarily. He spent a year in prison after pleading guilty to mail fraud. It was during that year in durance vile that Rice wrote the memoir I've been quoting so liberally from, cheekily titled My Adventures with Your Money. By the way, this memoir, which is of course in the public domain and you can read it online for free, is well worth the 2 or 3 hours it'll take to read. Like its author, it's every bit as entertaining as it is untrustworthy. Rice would have lots more adventures with Your Money in the years after his release, booming fake mining companies and publishing sketchy periodicals, making and gambling away vast quantities of money. He spent 4 years in federal prison in 1928 after being caught defrauding investors in a fake copper mine and earned the moniker the Jackal of Wall Street. He finally died in 1943. As for Larry Sullivan, he moved on to Mexico and tried to pull a George Graham Rice-type swindle down there, but was stymied by the fact that the mine he bought was an utter dud and he lacked the magic touch that Rice had with press releases and public relations. Later, he landed a job in Los Angeles, supposedly as a private detective working with Clarence Darrow for the release of the McNamara brothers, the men who blew up the Los Angeles Times building, killing 21 people as part of a labor strike. He was suspected of trying to bribe the jury, but nothing was ever proved. Sullivan then got involved in Mexican lotteries in Southern California for a while, until authorities clamped down on that. By the time he got back to Portland, all the things he knew how to do—run gambling houses, fix fights, and serve liquor—were illegal. He tried anyway, bounced around in and out of trouble with the law and calling in old markers to try to stay out of jail. Finally, when the First World War broke out, he ended up as a security man at a shipyard, quite possibly the first legitimate employment he'd entered into in his wild and colorful life. But by then, his health wasn't good enough to support a life of crime anymore. He died in 1918 of Bright's disease, nephritis of the kidneys, at the age of 55. Key sources in this story included works by Barney Blaylock, the lamented late dean of Portland waterfront historians, and, of course, George Graham Rice's own book, My Adventures with Your Money. That's our show for today. Thanks again for listening. This podcast is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. Offbeat Oregon History is a division of Pulplit Productions, a boutique publishing house, about which more can be learned at pulp-lit.com. In addition to Offbeat Oregon books, audiobooks, and this podcast, we publish book and audiobook versions of collections of what you might call street literature. 1920s pulp magazine writers like H.P. Lovecraft and Edgar Rice Burroughs, gothic penny dreadful titles like Sweeney Todd and The Adventures of Highwayman Dick Turpin, all straight shots of bottled-in Bond working man's fiction and working women's fiction from the last couple centuries. If that sounds like your jam, I'd love to have you check them out. You can find out more at pulp-lit.com. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band and was written by Carmen Ficarra. Listen and learn more at atlasstringband.com. Episodes of Offbeat Oregon History are uploaded around 6 a.m. every weekday, so the next one will be on your device and ready to go before you know it. Until then, go out and fill up the rest of the day with good stuff. Bye now.